You're listening to Podcast on Fire. It's Asian cinema in a podcast with your hosts, the magnificent trio of Stu, Ken, and Mike.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire 51. My name is Kenneth Wilson, your host for this evening, and with me is...
Matt.
Banner. And, yeah, look at that silence.
That's the silence where Stu should be.
Stu is due for other commitments this evening, and I'm being totally nice so far, so that's all I'm going to say about it. What do you have to say about it, Michael?
Nothing, really. Well, you know, if we can include an interactive element for the people at home, or, you know, wherever you're listening to this, so after we've had a discussion about a movie or something, we'll leave a little, like, 5-second gap for you to do your best impression of Stu, going, where is it, like?
Hi.
And then it'll feel like Stu's around.
Yes, four sentences to cover.
So a practice one, so it'd be... Oh, yeah, the fight scenes were tremendous in that film, yeah. But they really added to the drama. So, what did you think of it, Stu?
Hi.
Hi, is it right? There you go, just like that. So, you know, keep listening out for the gaps.
Yeah, we can do it. We can turn the tables on in that regard. And I bet people can do a four-sentence soundboard out of what I'm saying. And you as well. So, you know... We are predictable, all of us, to some degree. we have just happened to pick up on the structure of Stu.
Can you bum kisser?
That's all you're saying? That's one of your four sentences?
That's because Stu's... He's not around, you'd have to suck up to him, you know?
I'm too nice and too happy to be mean.
Well, yeah, that's not true, Sleazy K.
It's only a few minutes.
Dark side lurking.
It's only a few minutes into the show. I can get. Oh, by the way, I will get quite mean, or listeners will be quite offended, possibly by the movie I'm going to talk about and what I thought about the movie in last movies watched.
That's what I like to hear.
Yeah. So I rewatched. It was a long time I watched it, maybe 10 years ago. So. New watch, rewatch, Cannibal of Chungking Express, directed by Wong Kar-wai, and I can't connect to this film at all, personally. I'm a bit too smart to say that it's overrated because I in this case I think it's a movie where you just connect to it or you don't. But I watched it and I. Just to briefly run through the story for people who don't know about it. It's basically one half of the story of the cop played by Takeshi Kaneshiro and his longing, his sort of quirky longing after he's broken up with his girlfriend. And it's basically the same kind of situation when that half is done and Tony Leung Chiu-Hai enters, also playing a cop, who's just broken up with his girlfriend and the way these people handle it. And it's a very quirky... fairly charming movie and symbolic and a bit too arty, and really, the relationship between me and Wong Kar-wai's movies, is not really the best relationship. Having said that, I've not seen that many. I guess I've seen As Tears Go By, which is his first and rather ordinary movie. It's not an arty movie as such, and I've seen Ashes of Time, which is a brilliant film, in the original cut. Subtitles are great too, so just use your fucking brain, people. You can watch the original cut and still enjoy it. And basically this, Chungking Express, but I still have a feeling for Wong Kar-wai, and it's not... I can't connect to it, and what's good about it is that it's a very... it is a quirky movie, because these characters, they are longing for love, but... And when you're in that frame of mind, as a person, you do start to conduct yourself in a... You can conduct yourself in a rather strange way. Which, in these in the case of these people, it means that they're sort of stuck. They're not getting over the lost love. And Wong Kar-wai shows it in the case of Takeshi Kaneshiro. He looks for, I believe it was cases of, or tins of sardines that they must expire before May the 1st that year, because the prior year was the date his girlfriend broke up with him. So he desperately collects, cans with that expiry date limit on it, which is all fine, and I like the choice. It's quirky, it's fairly charming, and Tony Leung's kind of obsession was that. I guess I've already forgotten about the movie, really. but he talks with his stuffed Garfield doll, and he misses his stewardess girlfriend, so he plays, I believe, with a plane in one scene, and just, you go into that shell as a person, and there's something real about that. But it's really not much else for me in there. The music that repeats throughout the film, the Mamas and Papas song, California Dreaming, I believe it's called, played like 100 fucking million times throughout the movie. And therefore trying to symbolize, the longing that people have, these characters have to go to California. And I don't buy it, personally. I don't buy it. This doesn't affect me emotionally at all, that kind of symbolism. And I'm not against symbolism, making like symbolic gestures. But within this vibe, this kind of exotic Hong Kong vibe as well, it is set in like Sim Sha Tsui, Choi, and Chungking Mansion and stuff like that, I think, anyway. And these like really tight areas, and certainly when Fei Wong enters the story, she's part of the Tony Leung story. She hides in his apartment and sort of sneakily rearranges his apartment and cleans his apartment while he's out, and he doesn't notice that. Even she changes labels on his tinned food, and he doesn't even notice that. He sort of thinks, it tastes better. Sardines taste better. But there's only minor points there, and listen to the otherwise excellent Tony Raine's audio commentary on the Criterion DVD. Tony knows his stuff, and he certainly explains what he thinks certain moments in the film symbolizes. And I just look at that, then look at myself, and no, there's no connection for me there. And
I've only actually watched one Wong Kar-wai film, and luckily enough, it is actually Chungking Express. I didn't really, I can't say I loved it either. I really liked, the performances were really strong, I thought, on the whole.
Sure.
Takeshi Kaneshiro was really good, and really kind of drew me in. But then the actual story, or what there was of it, anyway, with Bridget Lin and stuff.
Yeah, she's drug smuggling, hitman, in a way.
Quite iconic with a blonde wig on.
Yeah.
And shaved.
Which just looks stupid to me, to be honest. I love Bridget Lin, but I think that just... You know what it reminded me of for some reason during this viewing? The way Leatherface looks in the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre. do you remember? Because he had the wig. It was something about the wig, and I don't know why I made that connection, but I just kept looking at that. It just reminds me of Leatherface.
I'll be honest, that didn't really spring to mind when I was watching it, but...
Yeah, well, it's...
Each to their own.
Yeah,
See where your mind's working.
Yeah, well, I'm a horror fan, for fuck's sakes.
I was thinking more like Madonna, or whatever shit film she was in before. The first story, I liked Takeshi Kaneshiro, but then I didn't really actually like that part of the story or anything. Mm. It definitely perked up when... Tony came in, and Fei Wong. I thought Fei Wong was excellent. I think it was a movie debut, was it?
Apparently Tony Raines did say that, yeah.
Yeah, she's very good in it, and...
sure, natural.
Actually, yeah, definitely. And Tony Leung is always really good. Doesn't matter what he's in.
Mm.
I quite enjoyed that story. I kind of failed to see where all the praise...
Exactly, because people are
warranted.
People are literally, this movie has hit them, low, like a like a sledgehammer emotionally. Not that they were like crying or anything, but they just connected to it massively. And I don't think it's due to the fact that the movie's and movie made in the 90s. It's just I just failed to see that. And you know, it's not a 2-star film or anything. It's a 3-star film with some minor quirks and fairly charming stuff. And but you know, it's I would rather watch like complex movies from the likes of Stanley Kwan. You know, director Rouge, Love Unto Waste, Center Stage, stuff like that. But it can be fairly arty, but it's just to draw kind of a vague comparison to another filmmaker.
Yeah. I think Sam, you actually just didn't connect with me. It was quite enjoyable. It was all right to pass a bit of time, but emotionally, it didn't really engage me. Not enough, anyway.
Certainly, I don't know if it's due to the age that you and I are at, but if this would have gone on forums, then you know, one opinion would have been, it's shit, it's overrated, and you are shit because of it. And then the circus would keep going. But I think you have to realize that if you don't like something, sometimes it's basically because you can't connect with it, and it's not necessarily a bad movie, because not all movies apply, not all people like all movies, to say a simple truth. So,
right then, what's next, Mr. Host?
Your last movies watched, or your last movies something, or your... You have the floor. You have the floor, sir.
All right then, last movie watched, going from mucho-praised Art House down to the dirty... Kung Fu Gutter.
Dirty.
Well, it's not actually dirty.
Titty, Bush, Beaver. Oh.
There you go, Sleazy K.
Yeah, it's coming out now.
Can't restrain him. Yeah. I watched Big Boss of Shanghai.
Ah, oh, yes.
Which stars the awesome Chen Kuan Tai, who is definitely, you know, a proper Shaw Brothers legend. And right up there with my favourite Shaw Brothers actors. So definitely think, well, he was a genuine martial artist competitor before he got into movies. And so he brings a certain authenticity with his two. But he's also just got a really unique style of fighting. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anybody who looks quite like Chen Kuan Tai when they're fighting, which is really cool.
How is it easily describable in words? That difference?
I don't know. There's something quite powerful about it, but also simple and kind of loose. I don't know how to explain it. It reminds me a little bit of the way Fu Sheng fought as well. Mm-hmm. Who's another one of my favourite screen fighters, because I don't think anybody fights quite like Fu Sheng either, apart from possibly. That might not make a lot of sense, paradoxically, there, saying nobody quite fights like him, except the bloke I've just mentioned. But I think one person I can think of would be fairly similar. But yeah, as well as skills and like a unique kind of fighting style, I think he brings a good bit of acting chops and proper kind of, you know, star quality charisma. You can see why he'd be the leading man or the lead villain.
Sort of big presence.
A lot of Shaw Brothers films, yeah. Definitely.
Big or rather noticeable presence. Not the early guy as such, but yeah.
I think presence is a good word for it. So it reminds me of like in Big Bad Sith, which is brilliant. Modern, which I'd be using in inverted commas. Shaw Brothers film, so like based in the 70s. Where he's not in it for most of the film, but when he does come into it, you're like, yeah, Chen's going to sort that shit out. He's the man. Anyway, this film is also directed by Chen Kuan Tai, and also co-stars Jimmy Lee. And actually, Chen and old Jimmy.
Is it, well, I guess Jimmy Lee, but I think it's Jimmy Leung as well. Lung Fong, the late Lung Fong, actually. He died not so long ago.
Right. They're two bevy mates who come from... Well, actually, you see them crawling over rocks and stuff at the beginning in this big valley. Like, almost literally coming straight out the rocks and into some small town where they go about, you know, trying to make some money, get some food. They do some kind of weird scam type joke at the beginning that I didn't really understand. But they seem to think it was really clever. You know, they lark about, try and get a bit of cash. And then they end up going to Shanghai. Working on the docks, and then the corrupt kind of dock bloke tries to scam them. So, you know, they smash his operation up and teach him a lesson. And then it all just, you know, it builds from there as they get more powerful and richer as time moves on. And Chen Kuai-tai becomes a big boss. But there's always a bit of, always running through a bit of a difference between the two. They're mates and brothers. Chen's kind of the upstanding, goody-two-shoes kind of person. Whereas Jimmy is feeling the avarice and just wants to make his way and become rich and powerful.
Where have I heard this story before?
Yeah. and so, you know they're going to come to blows and stuff. And it's all topped off with the main bad guy gangster being Chen Xing.
Hi.
Who is an awesome badass. Notably, well, for me anyway, he's a Buddhist monk in Iron Fisted Monk.
Yeah. Looking quite different. Okay, still big, but, you know, normally it's just like Quan Tai. It's big and the stash to go along with it. That's like Chen Xing.
Yeah. And, well, on a side note, Iron Fisted Monk is fucking ace.
It is.
Yeah, so it's Big Boss of Shanghai is kind of just your standard kind of kung fu flick, really. Little bit revenge, bit of, you know, teaching the scamsters and the unjust a lesson. It's nice to see, actually, for a change, that it's not directly the British or those damn Qing bastards. It's just, you know, fellow Chinese people who are on the make and kind of exploiting other Chinese people. Yeah, and so it's directed by Chen Kuai-tai, and another film that's directed by him is Iron Monkey. Not, you know, the undercranked and overhyped Donnie Yen film. But the 1977 movie. And Iron Monkey is a brilliant film. Really dark and gritty. Not a lot of laughs in it. But plenty of really good drama and cracking fights. And so after watching that and seeing what Chen Kuai-tai could do when directing, I had high hopes for this one. But it's just not in the same class, unfortunately.
You can definitely see him being part of a darker, more gritty story because he is enough of a big presence to sell that.
Yeah, definitely. And, flying guillotine. Although some might think that the basic premise of the weapon is a bit silly. That is a no-laughs, pretty dark, everybody gets sliced up kind of film. And, yeah, Chen stars in that, and it's a cracker. He's definitely got the skill set for it. Killer Constable. That's another film that's as dark as hell. I'm sure there's a film with Chen Kuai-tai in it. Yeah, so I think I was possibly a little unfairly, but a little bit disappointed by it because I was expecting more after watching Iron Monkey. I mean, it's basically just a cheap indie kung fu film that left me most of the time wishing it was missing and wishing that I was watching the Shaw Brothers film. Because just the sets, the costumes, the standard of... I mean, the stars are good, but the standard of the secondary tier of actors, The quality of the kung fu, pretty much everything is better in a Shaw Brothers film. But it does have some really nice moments, though. Usually just little touches, like when one guy gets stabbed, Chen Kwan Tai goes after the guy who stabs him, but Jimmy Lee kind of falls down next to the guy and pulls out his pocket watch, and almost at the same time just gives the knife that's sticking out this guy's chest a little smack so it goes in a bit further. And it's just little moments like that that lift it above the standard indie film. And there's a few of those, not too many, but there's a few of those kind of moments that are really good.
I remember liking the acid attack during the end.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool and rather, you know, gory and brutal and, you know, ooh, acid attack.
Yeah,
they actually did an effect of some sort.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Definitely it affects the way that he fights as well.
Yeah.
Which is good. Doesn't just carry on fighting regularly. Overall, it's an enjoyable kung fu film. Just tainted a little bit, I think, by my own expectations.
An easy watch enough, but very basic, I agree. And, you know, the bashing and, you know, sort of the fair intricacy on some of the fights, you know, stand out, but there's basically glimpses only, which, you know, I'm glad to have watched it, but it's not memorable as such, and wouldn't be too depressed if it never came to DVD. It's on VCD in widescreen finally, which is something it wasn't before. I think it was out on Vengeance in the UK.
Yeah, that's what I've got, the English dubbed full screen Vengeance.
Right.
DVD. But yeah, there's the Joy Sales VCD out of the current run of Joy Sales releases. Right, so that's me moving out. Alright then, seeing as Stu's not around and we can do whatever we like. Have you got any problems with that, Stu? Nope, didn't think so. So, because the boss man, aka Brains, isn't around, I've decided to do a new section. So, first up, although this is actually quite old, it was relatively new news to me. So, because it's news to me, I'm going to call it news. And it might be news to somebody else. And also, because, you know, I'm hosting a podcast and you ain't, so I'm going to do what I like.
Are you like Borat? You know, he and Kazakhstan were like 10, 15 years behind everything.
Yeah, it could be that.
Don't tell us who killed JR.
So this is Tony Jaa related news. So obviously Tony Jaa's awesome. And haven't heard much from him since he went a little bit mental and had to go and sit in a cave and meditate for a couple of months after the huge problems he had on directing, starring, and doing whatever else on Ong Bak 2, which also includes a little bit in Ong Bak 3. It's Tony's changed his name. Not his English name, he's going to stick with Tony Jaa, there's no point changing that, no. That just confused people. But in Thailand, he's changed his official, actual, you know, regular signing checks kind of name, his proper legal name. Now, his original name, apparently what he was given at birth, I believe, is Warawit Yiram. So that's what his mama and papa chose for him. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a meaning for that, so I don't know what that is. Might mean nothing. and then, apparently, around about on that time, he changed it to Panam Yiram. And I've seen him listed as Jaa Panam Yiram. And apparently, Panam means mountain. So I don't know if that's like, you know, apparently it's actually not all that uncommon. In fact, it's fairly common for Thai people to change their names and do it legally. So I think in England, it's kind of seen as you either do it if, you know, you want to get rid of your surname or something like that because of, you know, estranged parents or something like that. Or if you're a bit of a nutcase and you change your name to ZZ Top because you're a big ZZ Top fan or something.
Moonstar. some weird odd name like that.
Or like in the Big Brother in Britain this year, where two of the housemates have to change their name by Deepole to be allowed into the house.
Uh-huh.
A girl had to change her name to Dogface, and a bloke had to change his name to Halfwit, which I think is quite funny. Yeah, screw you.
Big Bro is awesome.
So I'm guessing when On Back came around, and you know, he's making a big film, and you know, trying to be a big star and everything, changed his name to Mountain, something big and powerful, mm-hmm. imposing. And now, I think after, you know, all the trouble with On Back 2, he decided to change his name again. Because, you know, I think quite a few Thai people are fairly superstitious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of people around the world are superstitious. But that your name can have, can be, you know, have bad spirits or bad luck, or if you change your name to something new or good or better, that, you know, that might affect your luck or how the spirits are going to treat you, that kind of thing.
Mm, sure.
And so after all his thing with Ong Bak Su, the problems there, he's changed his name to Touchacorn Yuma. Now, Touchacorn is spelled T-H-A-T-C-H-A-K-O-R-N, but it's pronounced Touchacorn, which apparently, depending on, I've seen two kind of, well, actually, to be fair, Tony Jaa said, it means great inventor. So it's like, you know, somebody who's creative or innovative, or, you know, it's something started afresh and something new and creation.
Because, yeah, maybe it sounds, maybe it is less pompous than it sounds.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That's probably like the closest English translation you'll get.
Right.
Loses a little bit of the meaning, maybe. Or I saw somebody else on the Tony Jaa forum who translated it. Now, this could be just maybe he's picked it because there's two different meanings to it, or this is just another way of interpreting the Thai name. But also it comes out as, like, flags holder, which could be seen as a nice kind of, you know, nationalistic kind of name.
Sure.
You know, he's, you know, proud of being Thai or something like that, I don't know. But apparently the way he chose it was, he went to see an Agan, which I could be pronouncing incredibly wrong, but that's like a Thai word, it's like Shifu in Chinese, it means like teacher, but it's not just like, you know, school teacher or kung fu teacher, it could be like, you know, a mystic or a monk or, you know, somebody who's going to impart wisdom and stuff to you. And apparently he saw one of these Agans, and the guy gave him, like, 10 names that he thought would be good to change to. And so Touchacorn, the great inventor, was the one that Tony got the sound of. And that's what he went with. So now he's officially Touchacorn Yuram. But in Thailand, he'll be Japanam still. And in the West, he'll still be Tony Jaa.
Maybe it's a nice timing for a change now that Ong Bak 3 is coming out. Whenever it is coming out, you know, he's coming over his past, you know, the big mental challenges he faced. And sort of a reboot, if you will, maybe? Or a new start?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't believe in superstition or that kind of stuff, but I can see the kind of the logic or the thought process, and if you've had a really tough time, and you're kind of trying to come out the other end, or you are coming out the other end, kind of, you know, change your name, give yourself a fresh start, if that makes you feel fresh, or like you're reinventing yourself.
Yeah, it's, you know, whatever calms the soul, really. I mean, whatever solution you choose, it might be rooted in superstition, but you're only choosing it for that particular moment because it suits you for that particular moment. It gives calm in your soul during that particular moment, so whatever you gotta do. So,
and it's a little bit like David Bowie changing his names in his characters for his shows.
Mm-hmm.
And David Bowie is fucking cool,
and therefore you can draw any parallel to anything and include David Bowie.
Yeah,
cool.
And you know, if it's alright with Bowie, it's alright with me.
Mind that.
So that's my first bit of news. And like I said, I mean, I think this happened back in February or something.
News to me, so I don't mind it.
There we go. News to me as well. Yeah. And a little bit of Thai culture on the show, even though I know diddly squat about Thai culture, apart from what I learnt in
movies.
About a dozen films and a couple of hours of research on the internet.
Yeah, well, you know, we rarely encounter Thai culture on the show, so therefore you're our gateway into it. Even though we're only touching upon it a little bit, that's quite valid and noble. And changing names is an important thing to know of.
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay, so that almost, sort of, if you want to use a tenuous link, brings us on to my second piece of news, which is actually far more up-to-date. Only a linkage in so far as we're going to more kind of 70s exploitation kung fu-ness. And Bruce Lee.
He died.
He did die, yeah, unfortunately. But I think it's the 36th anniversary, or it was recently, of his death. Or it will be this year anyway, I can't remember.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah, 73, yeah, so it would make sense.
But there was... it's kind of linked this story actually to his home that he used to have in Hong Kong. Used to be some kind of love motel where they rented rooms by the hour. So I've got a feeling that would be where prostitutes went with their clients. But a rich kind of Chinese guy called Yu Panglin bought the place, and I think he's a big Bruce Lee fan. So he's bought the place and he's given it to the Hong Kong government so they can turn it into a museum for Bruce Lee. And apparently he's put up a prize to design the restoration project for the building. It's pretty cool. But at the launch for this design thing, they were shown an 8-minute trailer for a new biopic. About Bruce Lee, but through the eyes of his former girlfriend, apparently.
Betty Ting Pei?
Yeah, Betty Ting Pei, Nora Nguyen, and a few other people.
Right.
So it's kind of focused, well, I don't know if it's focused on his love life, but that's kind of what it seemed like, from what I've read.
Was the movie or documentary?
I assume it's a documentary if it's features interviews from Nora and other people involved.
I heard you said biopic before, so I became unsure.
Yeah, well, that's what it said in the news.
Right.
But yeah, it seems like a documentary. But I found, interestingly, it's directed by Ng Sie Yun.
Oh, there you go.
Who is the director of... a director, writer and producer. He's directing, he knocked out Invincible Armour and Secret Rivals, amongst others.
Mm-hmm.
Two much loved, widely considered classics of the kung fu genre. Also, he wrote Snake in the Eagle's Shadow and Drunken Master, which were Jackie's big two.
Yeah, produced also. Yeah.
Yeah. And he produced No Retreat, No Surrender. The Jean-Claude Van Damme film, which was directed by Corey Yoon. I think, you know, he's got a pretty stacked filmography of credits for producing and writing and directing, if you have a look at it, from the 70s up to, a couple of years ago, really. I think Legendary Assassin, the Wu Jing film, he had some role in that, producing or something, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And Once Upon a Time in China films, he produced a few of those.
And Dunbar's Exploitation. Too. He directed Tower of Death, Game of Death 2.
Yeah, of course.
Which is a great, dumb film, but, yeah.
Yes,
yeah, yeah, I mean, he's a producer, so why be surprised that he went into Bruce Exploitation at least once?
Yeah.
It's still one of the better ones, despite it being dumb and stupid, it's still one of the better ones, because it's dumb and stupid.
Yeah, so I think, I find that interesting anyway, that he's going to be doing the, we're directing, anyway, which he hasn't done for a long time, and doing a documentary as well. That might be... See, I've got a slight problem with these kind of films, or documentaries and things like that that come out after such a famous kind of much-loved person has died, or, you know, things about Elvis and things like that. It's that it's generally just a load of nut-hugging. It's all one-sided, oh, he was great. He was great, wasn't he? Now, I know people, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be too keen on talking smack about the dead. And in terms of Bruce Lee, it's within the Bruce Lee Foundation or whatever their name is, who look after his rights and stuff. You know, not to tarnish the Bruce Lee legend or anything in any way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's always kind of, you know, oh, he was awesome, oh, wasn't he great?
It's not like, I mean, you could always dig up dark stuff about people, but what we do know, Bruce Lee, and so there's so to say dark stuff, you know, what's the point of even bringing him up? It's not like, you know, and he eliminated Jews, you know, you know, in his spare, you know, he raped little children in his spare time. It's not like a scandal in that regard. I mean, so there's no conspiracy or cover up going on here.
I'm not saying there is, but I'm not endorsing muckraking or anything like that for the sake of, you know, sensationalism, or just, you know, for muckraking's sake. But I'd much rather have a complete view of a person if you're going to do a biopic or a documentary. You know, as Oliver Cromwell famously said, warts and all.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, I can agree with that. Yeah.
You know, people aren't all good, and most of the time, you know, we're not going to be all bad either. But you know, that's what makes people interesting.
Yes.
And so I'd be interested in, you know, Bruce Lee cheating on his wife, or Bruce Lee bullying somebody, or, you know, the bad side as well as the good side of Bruce, because, you know, just because they've got flaws in their personality, it doesn't tarnish their reputation or legend or make them any less great. It just makes them more interesting, I think, and more human.
Yeah, if you look at it through, you know, look at it that way, you know, the way you described it, it's not, therefore it doesn't reek of exploiting or, you know, just providing gossip, basically. So I can fairly agree on that, actually. I wouldn't look down on a human that has, you know, dark spots in his soul or holes in his soul or have you, or, you know, it does make for a more human portrait. So
yeah,
but
so
did this seem like that, or it came off as, you know, tribute?
I don't know anything about it. I haven't seen the trailer. I think the trailer, well, they call it a trailer in the news story, was only shown at this event so far, and it was 8 minutes long, so it's more like a promo reel,
right,
kind of thing. I'm just hoping it's not. I'm hoping it's going to be a bit more. I mean, one of the quotes from Bruce Lee's brother, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, so I haven't got the quote in front of me right now, but it was along the lines of, yeah, Bruce, you know, if you pick one girl to go out with, then the others would get really angry. As in, you know, he had a few women going at the same time. And so often, he'd just go out with his brother instead, to save any bother. So now that's kind of, you know, it's kind of, you know, maybe a bit of a flaw, but also just part of his personality, something people would like, you know, a bit of a playboy. But it's real. And so, hopefully, if it contains, like, more stuff like that, then it might not just be a kind of whitewashy, let's hooray for Bruce Lee, and rake in a bit of extra cash from the fans kind of deal. It might actually uncover a bit more about what he was like.
And there's no shortage of Bruce Lee documentaries anyway in that regard, so...
Hell no.
It's, speaking of that, I watched this Rarescope DVD where... I don't remember the movie. I think it was Hong Kong Godfather, which was a movie that Bruce supported in some way. Just wished the production good luck. And Betty Ting Pei's in it. Stars Michael Chan.
Chan Wei Man.
Really bad basher. Right. Boring as hell. but there's a documentary on that disc. That documentary called The Last Days of Bruce Lee. Which is this 10-minute kooky little thing where... It seems like this... They put it together... shortly after his death, and it showed footage from the funeral and also from the ceremony that Hong Kong Godfather had before production. So he was there. But it's like a letter of defense from Betty Ting Pei, this documentary, basically. But it's because everyone was, you know, blaming her because she died in his apartment, and there was all rumors about her and Bruce Lee going out, which I don't know by now has been proven right or wrong, I don't know. But, you know, gossip started to fly around that time, basically. And I can understand why they did it, but there's this kooky element where she's interviewed in a setting where she's on a chair, but the whole floor is covered with newspapers, you know, all containing the headlines, the gossipy headlines and the news in general. It's just this really kooky thing they put together. It doesn't really help that it's really badly English dubbed as well. You know, it seems very amateurish, but it's on YouTube, and I'm going to link to that documentary. It's quite fun, and to see what they attempted in that regard, to calm down the public and to try and get the newspapers off her back. But, you know, Mary, good luck.
You know,
good luck.
Bruce was known to be a bit of a lad.
Yeah.
Betty Ting Pei and Norm Yu were hot. I'm not surprised that stuff happened.
Yeah. So if you had that DVD lying around and haven't seen that, Mike, Hong Kong Godfather DVD.
I don't even think I'll be picking it up now, seeing if you
well, the film. Yeah, well, it's on... it's short, but it's really bad, you know. No distinction whatsoever. That's a basher. Really boring.
Sure, I could pick it up somewhere.
Yeah. But the documentary we've got a link to, it's quite fun. Any more telegrams from the world of news?
No, that's
according
it.
According to Mike.
See, February news, right up to news from just a few days ago.
Yeah, good one.
Not bad.
And I didn't know of either of the items, so you've enlightened me.
At the very least, you've learned something, Ken.
Yeah.
What do you
isn't
think?
Isn't that gratification enough, by the way?
Oh, yeah, it is. That's all I need. Right. Did you enjoy those news stories, Stu? There we go.
So, the only questions left and right here. Basically, since I don't know anything about this and can't bring anything to this question, I'll just have to leave it up to Mike to make the best of it. So, someone submitted on the site a question, the main site, podcastonfire.com, which you can do if you scroll down to a little section to write in the site there, saying, send us your questions, the little questionnaire there, and you can ask any question you like. And a girl writes the following. Stu didn't mention any name, so it's a girl.
Question from a lady.
Yeah.
Hey guys,
I love your show. And that was it. No, I'm just kidding.
You should do it in a girly voice, Ken.
No, I should not.
Stu would do it in a girly voice.
I only like to imitate people, you know, really badly.
Yeah, I don't think you should really like that.
No, I don't think so. So, properly. Hey guys, I love your show. Thank you. I'll be moving to London in the fall to pursue a master's degree. Whoa. And I'm wondering where the best places to find Hong Kong movies are. Thanks. A master's degree and then being a Hong Kong cinema fan. Wow. So, Mike, any good tips where to find Hong Kong movies in London?
Well, I don't live in London, but I've been there. But I've got a feeling, well, for a kickoff, I've got, seeing as she put fall instead of autumn or anything like that, I'm going to guess she's from North America.
Okay.
I'm coming over to a foreign country looking for some Hong Kong flicks.
So get out!
Yeah. Well, I think my general answer would be I wouldn't bother going to London to find films. You know, you got to hit up the internet. It's the only place worth shopping for things like that. I mean, you can go to HMV, Virgin, the big kind of, you know, entertainment stores, the big chain ones, and they'll have quite a few Asian films, world cinema. You'll get quite a lot of Korean and Japanese cinema and things in there, a lot of classics. Usually you've got anime is really popular over here, so you get plenty of that. Martial arts, you get plenty of films in there. All the Hong Kong ones, not as popular as Japanese, I don't think, in Korean, because I think, especially the Japanese, I've got more of a
They just don't stock as much, because there certainly are releases out there. We talked about the different companies releasing stuff, but
there's plenty of Hong Kong films released. I just get the sense that Japanese films are a bit more popular because they were kind of more advanced, you know, as in skills-wise, technically, and quite art-housey, a lot of them and stuff. And so I think, you know, get good reviews, and a lot of cinema fans, kind of the serious cinema fan, would enjoy that rather than kung fu flicks and that kind of thing. But obviously Hong Kong films nowadays are a lot slicker. But it's still a bit kind of Hollywoody, popcorny, slickness, mainstream, full of pop stars, that kind of stuff. But yeah, you can get Hong Kong movies. If you're actually wanting to get, you know, Hong Kong, DVDs from Hong Kong or from around the world and things like that, then there's Chinatown. And there's a few Chinatowns. It's in Birmingham, in Manchester, London, possibly some other places. London Chinatown's quite nice, lots of restaurants, things like that. But it's the same in Birmingham as it is in London. I would never, ever, 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 ever buy a film from one of the shops, because they're incredibly expensive all the time. I honestly don't know who buys films from Chinatown. For example, you can go in Chinatown and they will have, some brand new releases, but a few kind of older films from the past year or two on BCD for £10 and £12 each.
For fuck's sake.
The one in Birmingham, if they had a sale in there of a few items, and these were films that are good 5-6 years old on BCD, on sale for £5. Now, put that in perspective. If you're in Hong Kong, you can pick up VCDs for, like, £1, £1.50, £2 maybe. If you go online to places like BioYo and DVD House, you can pick them up for £2, £2.50, something like that, with a bit of shipping, per film. So for that 10 or 12 quid, you could get 4 to 5 movies and get them delivered to your house. So I really wouldn't recommend Chinatown. And like I'm saying, I don't know who would get them from there. Because, you know, the kung fu fans or the big Asian movie fans will surely know loads of websites and stuff to get them from. From the internet. And I can't imagine Chinese people going there because, one, they'll probably have relatives in China and Hong Kong who can send them to them for, like, nout. Or there's just so many bootlegs swimming around in China. And they're around Britain as well, that it'd be really easy. I mean, the Chinese people I know mostly watch bootlegs or come back from China or Hong Kong with big fistfuls of bootlegs that they've bought off the market. So I honestly don't get who's buying them from Chinatown. In Camden, I don't know if it still goes on, but there were people there who would sell kung fu flicks specifically, but also some Hong Kong action flicks and stuff, and could do a nice line in rare stuff, you know, as in rare copies, if you ask them nicely. So I think around Camden, I don't know if the guys there are still doing it, but you can pick up old kung fu flicks and Hong Kong films from there.
Didn't Toby Russell used to have a stand somewhere, actually be there himself and sell movies
in Camden, in fact?
Yeah, it was okay.
Because there's a big market out there, and it's quite kind of trendy. So there's a lot of students.
I think that's a thing of the past for him.
Oh yeah, certainly. Yeah, Toby used to. In fact, our own Philip Mills, Esquire, Mm-hmm. Lord and Master of FarEastFilms.com. Used to buy films from Toby Russell, I believe, back in the day. And of course, Toby used to own a couple of shops. I mean, right back in the day, we're talking 80s, possibly the early 90s as well.
I think one of the Eastern Hero shops was located in Camden because they shot an opening for one of their video magazines where Jonathan Ross opened them. So I think, and that was like 93, 94, maybe 95.
In fact, Mr. Philip Mills gets around a bit. It was actually at that event when Jonathan Ross was opening the show, the shop. I'm not sure he's actually on the video, but he was there.
I'm going to find him now. I'm going to find him now and put it on YouTube.
So back in the day, there used to be a couple of shops, and even further back in the day, Flashlegs Rare, which is now a kind of small rare movie trader, they used to sell VHSs when they were like much sought after, and people would pay 50 quid for an old Shaw Brothers film on video. There used to be a shop, so back in the day, there used to be shops galore, or at least a good selection of stuff, but nowadays, it's either mainstream shops, you might come across a few marketplaces, no point going to Chinatown. I would just say buy them off the internet. I know it's not the same as, like, you know, physically going to a shop, having it there and then. The kind of thrill of, you know, excitement of finding something really cool, a little diamond in the rough, or, you know, some wheat in the chaff. But it's just so hard to do, and usually quite expensive. But I'd just go on the internet.
Yeah, times have changed, as you talked about. It really isn't the same anymore. And I actually became really nostalgic now with you when you were talking about it, like buying VHSs, you're browsing for stuff. I mean, one of my best memories from childhood, believe it or not, I mean, I'm a film geek, so it makes sense, was walking through, you know, my local video rental place, which had two stories to it. One was porn, but still two stories. It's the 80s, this. And just being fascinated as a child of all the different artwork and what, in fact, the movies behind that artwork contained. Because it seemed like, you know, I mean, you know, the most fantastical shit you ever seen, or the nastiest shit you ever seen. And painted artwork as well on these extremely large VHS boxes, even larger than normal. I remember seeing Bruce Lee movies like Big Boss, these painted covers, not artworks per se, but, you know, painted covers. And I could walk around there for hours and just look at movies. And in the end, I just had to rent, of course, a children's movie, because at the time I wasn't old enough to see anything else, obviously. But I remember specifically, non-Hong Kong related, I always stopped and looked at the cover of the Deep, the Nick Nolte film. It's like a 70s film written by the same guy who wrote Jaws, the book, I think. And it has a shot of a woman way below the surface of the water. And obviously I knew that Jaws had a similar cover art, only obviously with the added shark. So, but I automatically thought that that's another Jaws, and I would never dare to see that. You know, it's just wonderful to just browse. I guess it comes down to that. You just can't, in terms of movies anymore, browse. And I miss that. I actually do. And I mean, that's the 80s, and I guess it absolutely could be applied to the 90s as well. I mean, talking about these Eastern Hero shops, the video that they shot that day of the stock that they had on the shelves and stuff looked wonderful. Yes, would be wonderful to just look at that. They had laser discs at that time. Boy, you know, I would have ejaculated immediately if I could go back and browse through laser discs. It's big ass fucking things. You know, one of the segments in the video is Rick Baker's in Hong Kong, and he browses laser discs, and here's the Drunken Master 2 laser disc. You know, at the time, just I don't know. It just makes me happy. In a way, it makes me happy, despite me not being able to go back to that time. It just makes me happy thinking about it, rather than longing in a painful way.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's a trade-off between you lose some of the mystery, or you lose the mystery and the excitement of, you know, just stumbling into, like you said, the video store and looking at the covers and spotting a film, or You know, hitting a market stall and discovering a new film or that kind of thing. You lose that. But then that's an exchange for a wealth of opportunity and availability and knowledge. So the reason why you're not going to be finding little treasures and things like that is because you're not going to be surprised by anything, because you can find out who's released what and where and when and how much and what for detail. So it has kind of lost some of the excitement and stuff like that, but you know, you can get cheap films really, really easily.
I mean, yeah. By now, I mean, I'm the last, you know, going on like 8 or 9 years of, you know, hardcore Hong Kong movie watching. I mean, obviously, I've experienced so much that I, at a pace that I never had before. So, you know, it's now gonna be like two distinct memories or phases in my life, if you will. You know, the browsing phase where I couldn't do anything about it. And eventually, you know, going through everything, Hong Kong movies or otherwise.
Yeah, well, I mean, two things I was going to say. I remember when I was at uni, in the late 90s, there was a store and it sold, they had a really tiny DVD section. But the rest of the shop, which is just really basic, was all VHS. Because we were still watching VHS then. DVD was a newfangled thing and expensive.
Yeah.
Well, around our parts anyway. Well, a student then anyway. And so it was one of those kind of bargain shops where they sell what they can get hold of. And so you didn't know exactly what was going to be in there week to week. So they'd always go and wander in and they'd have like new Jackie Chan films, like, you know, the Lucky Stars movies or Project A Part 2 or... I remember one day my friend had kept going on about this film that he loved for ages, and then he spotted it one day in this shop and brought home Last Hurrah for Chivalry on VHS, the John Woo film.
Yeah, exactly. Wonderful film.
Yeah, so that was a great night in watching that and enjoying it with each other and having a laugh. I was like, yeah, it was, you know, that kind of stuff is hard to come by nowadays. And also, I know you miss the immediacy of walking around a shop and buying stuff.
Yeah.
But I actually like making a nice big order from usually BioYo or Timegamart or one of the shops like that where it pays to order a lot in one go to save on postage. Yeah. And when you get your little parcel come through, and it's a little bit like Christmas or a birthday or something, you've got like a little present in front of you.
I can actually agree on that. I mean, it's a wonderful trade-off in a way, too, you know. Still, yeah, I agree, it's fun.
So, here we go. See, if I'd actually really thought, this is a little insight into the making of Pop. If I'd actually, I'd thought about the question beforehand, but if I actually prepared an answer and wrote all this out, with points and things like that, this might have sounded a lot smoother to your ears, dear listeners. At the moment, it's just rambling and bambling as I remember things on the hoof.
I think still a sensible answer coming from 2009.
Well, I was going to say, because I'm adding something else on. Computer exchanges, I actually quite like. It's usually goes by the name Kex or Sex. It's C-E-X. Kex being slang up north for pants, underwear, or sex, because, you know, obviously, sex.
I know that.
Yeah. But they sell like tons of computer, you know, mobile phones nowadays, and loads of Xbox, PlayStation 3, that kind of stuff, games. Brand new, but mostly second-hand. But they always, because it's that kind of geeky shop, you get quite a few anime and Asian films on DVD. Mm-hmm. And so you can get anything from brand new stuff in there, you know, new releases, to the old Better Tomorrow release by, I can't even remember the company that released it there.
MIA in the UK, if you're referring to
it. It could be, on DVD from years back for like 50p, you can pick that up, or £1 on second hand. So if you go in there, you can definitely root around and find old DVDs for almost nothing. I bought Gen Y Cops. as in Gen X Cops 2. I bought that for 25p.
Yeah, Paul Rudd marathon on then. You know, many good Paul Rudd movies, and then put on that crud at the end. What the fuck is this?
I like the Rudd.
Yeah, I do. I do like the Rudd, but that's like, wow, what a standout.
Well, I've heard it was crappy, and it looks a bit crappy, yeah. But it was 25p.
Absolutely. I mean, unless you're like one of those freaks that desperately need to sell everything they buy and make a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of profit on it. You know, you can just chuck this in the bin if you like, if you don't like it. I mean, what the fuck?
You'd have to play 3D with it.
Yeah.
Melt it.
Yeah.
Do anything I want with it.
Fucking play beefs and butter with it, you know. Fire.
Give it to somebody I don't like for a present.
Put it in the microwave and see how long it takes before to microwave. Look at that. That's how it works. I'm a Mythbuster.
Plenty of things you can do. Yes, sir.
By the way, I'm not encouraging to do that at home, kids.
I think
I'm going to cut that out.
You wuss. To put a warning at the beginning of the show, do not attempt anything that the podcast people will tell you.
You're not a professional, neither are we.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I quite like that shop. If you want to route around, there's bound to be quite a few pure exchanges in London. I think that's answered.
I think that's a very good answer.
Answered and then some.
So, welcome to London, whoever you are, a girl. Hope your studies goes well, and hope you find Hong Kong movies on DVD, online or otherwise.
Yeah, and keep listening and sending us questions and stuff.
Yeah.
We like girls. There it can.
Yeah, we do. We like listeners.
We do.
We like kudos.
We're liking it all.
We need much of it. Much of it. Alright. So, moving on. I've actually written in the script a band segment, but it's actually an underrated segment because there's no use to have a band segment because there's no one here with a band list. But it's actually an underrated segment, so... For the last year or so, I've been really fascinated by what's been coming out of Taiwan. And I'm not talking recent movies, I'm talking old movies on DVD from Taiwan. Released, many of these were released by Hoka Records. And all of a sudden, good prints of old Taiwan movies, swordplay, martial arts, romances, or what have you, all of a sudden surfacing in Taiwan, and I never thought this would happen, and it has led to discovery of movies you've heard of, so Bridget Lin romances and stuff like that, but also movies you've never heard of. I watched The Ghost Hill from 1971, a wuxia, very colorful one, directed by Ding Xin-sai, veteran Taiwan director. But among other things, it did the excellent Chiang Pei-pei movie Whiplash, which is one of the best, you know, really brutal Golden Harvest movies from the time.
I like the way you said that. Welcome.
Whiplash. I don't know if it has an exclamation mark in its original title, so but it does now. His last movie, he did some stuff with Yimmy Wang Yu, but his last directed movie was with Yimmy Wang Yu, which was coincidentally his last movie as well. The Beheaded 1000, this cheap 90s new wave kind of wuxia movie. Fun in its own right, but he had a career from the 60s up until the 90s. I don't know if it's passed on by now, but Ding Xin-sai was behind The Ghost Hill, starring Polly Kwan, famous for her role in King Hu's Dragon Inn, among other things. She made a splash in that movie. I bet she was like 16 or 17 when she made Dragon Inn, but boy was she good. She has fire in her eyes, you know, fury.
Very popular lady amongst some of the kung fu movie loving community.
Yeah, she's I like the likes of Chiang Pei-pei better, but it's never wrong with a Polly Kwan, with Polly Kwan's presence. So a little bit about the plot, a very clear plot considering the genre it is. So, rival swordsman Tsai, played by Chen Peng, and Jun Feng, David Tong, they are forced to unite against a common enemy called King Gold, because he stole the purple light sword Tsai won in a duel against Jun Feng. So they need to retrieve the sword. Obviously, it can't fall into the wrong hands. King Gold tries to get the swordsmen turning against each other, though. But eventually, they realize what the actual truth is, and they are joined by Yen, played by Paul Kwan, and they head to Gold Mountain to try and conquer the multiple obstacles waiting. And this gives way to a wonderfully exciting and creative, colorful, you know, in the fantasy realm, kind of swordplay movie. You know, it's not just flying. It's not just the odd weapon. This is the full-on fireworks assault of color. You know, it's not too far removed from, like, if you've seen it, Holy Flame of the Martial World, the Shaw Brothers movie.
I haven't seen it yet. I've been meaning to get that for a while, but the DVD's out of print.
Right.
Wellgo USA are releasing it in the US with an English dub and everything.
It's excellent. That's like wild, colorful, bam, bam, bam. You know, just wonderful entertainment. And that, you know, before it becomes really colorful and extravagant, Ghost Hill, it sort of goes for the usual genre staples. You know, supremacy in the Wuxia world. Whoever heard of that plot strand?
I love that plot.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing wrong with it, but, you know, you're not thinking when you're seeing that, ooh, this is unusual.
She's pushing my boundaries.
Exactly. And a plethora of characters, obviously, always. But in the end, Ding Xinzai settles down and chooses a very simple story template because he's very busy stylistically. And that's a terrific choice. He sort of teases early that he's on top of his game as one character. In the first scene, there's a character watching the duel between the two main characters, and after the duel is done, he actually breaks down like a sports commentator exactly how he lost. You know, it's a flashback, and he shows specific sections where, you know, this move was bad and stuff like that. And it's quite a good stylistic sequence, even though my explanation sounds, you know, really basic and sort of tame, but after this, the Ghost Hill will, like, tenfold display the cinematic possibilities when depicting the Wuxia world. It's filled with, like, colorful inclusions such as a poison plant, an ice prison, which is the best fucking set in the movie. It's literally an ice prison only guarded by guards, you know, who can withstand being in the ice. Anyone entering it will, you know, immediately freeze. But the prisoners are safe and secure, they're just locked in. You know, it's a big set. It's just a wonderful, wonderful big set. And there's fire pits as well, which is cool because they go through the ice prison, survive that, and then they're into the fire pits, you know, extreme cold, extreme heat. And creative violent traps, and just fairly delightful and entertaining. And it's just an unpredictable amusement park ride. And to top it all off, it has this wonderful, a superb villain, King Lion, and he bathes. Is this a rather large actor, fat actor, if you will? He bathes in hot oil, but that's something only he could survive because there are scenes where they throw regular people in that hot oil and they just disintegrate. and it's on screen. I mean, much of this is on screen. It's actually very well depicted. It's not cheap effects as such. They don't cut away from it. And so it's really top stuff from Taiwan. And the veteran Ding Xinzai shows that, you know, the relatively early life of the Wuxia movie that this is, 1971 is still early in the game, he shows that Taiwan cinema certainly was, you know, King Hu was the master, and everyone else tried to be King Hu, but not many movies could reach any good level, to be honest. It was just movies that came out and went. But this movie proves that you could elevate your local cinema if you had the right skill. The tools might have been there, but Ding Xinzai has the right skill, and it's just a 5-star wonderful movie. It just blew me away. And it's available on DVD with English subtitles. It's a widescreen print, very good quality. For those anal turds out there, it's not anamorphic, but why the fuck does that matter when that movie is so excellent? It's a discovery. I don't think this movie was very well known before this DVD hit. And if it was well known, then it wasn't very available, I think. Maybe a full screen, you know, subtitled version, and who could follow that?
Well, I hadn't heard of it until the Hoka releases from last year.
Yeah.
I think it flew under the radar a bit.
Yeah. But this is just, wow. Rarely do I go wow when I watch this genre in any movie nowadays. And it's not because I'm cynical or anything, but you watch so much, and I watch so much crap. that good movies don't line up after each other often. So, fair recommendation to you, because you're a fan of that genre, and I'm sure you get a sort of kick out when the wuxia genre is elevated to that extremely colorful and fantastical level.
Yeah, well, I wanted to get it before, but yeah, I definitely want to get it now. Another thing as well about the Hoka releases, they use original artwork.
I'm pretty much
all of them for the front covers, and they look awesome. The poster
absolutely.
For Ghost Hill, I think we should plot that on the pop main page.
Yeah.
That's gorgeous, that poster.
Exactly.
It's like you were saying about in being in the video store and when you were a little kid and walking around and things catching your eye.
Yeah.
That kind of painted artwork for posters and on this DVD, there's just so much energy and stuff going on in it.
Yeah.
Instantly catches your eye and makes it look really dramatic and exciting.
You know, the cool thing is that they probably did churn out these posters really quickly, but that means they had really good artists doing that back in the day. You know, just put that and that and that on a poster, and then still a masterpiece of post art came out, because there were so many movies. You know, it's assembly line filmmaking.
Yeah, well, that's the slight problem, and with modern technology is that any clown with Photoshop and a laptop thinks they can knock together awesome covers like me. Or, you know, specifically professionals, and you can end up with crap.
Yeah.
Quite regularly. I mean, boring generic stuff. I just love those posters.
Yeah. I mean, you can see the contrast in that regard with your Thai show releases that presumably had the regular Celestial boring Photoshop shit on one side and the original on the other side.
Yeah, basically. Occasionally, the Thai releases slightly differ the artwork.
Right.
Some are slightly different shots or slightly differently composed, but on the whole, yeah, Celestial, and then not all of them, but some of them have reversibles with the original poster artwork.
Hmm. A Holy Flame on the Martial World, though, is a groovy recommendation. It's one of those 80s movies in the declining Shaw Brothers climate that, you know, you didn't expect something that creative. That's done in a time where they really could do that. They had more tools in the 80s to really crank up the style. And despite Max Mock and people in it being in it, Max Mock, before he really established himself, he was a contract player at that time. I mean, it's a great fun. And Philip Kwok, I think, is in it. He has a mean laugh in the movie. That's one of his weapons.
Right.
So, ha 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 ha, and they turn, you know, can make the world basically quake with his laugh. but yeah, cool that you mentioned that it's getting an additional DVD release outside of the Hong Kong one, because the Hong Kong one was good. It was original mono sound and everything, but an English dub on that would be. It's actually, I won't spoil it for you, but it's like a monster in the film that speaks English originally.
Hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, a few lines of dialogue. It's not they're not having conversations with it, but that's the feature in that monster. It speaks English briefly. So, rock and roll.
It definitely sounds like something I want to watch.
Yeah, it's a good contrast to like the multiple Choi Yun, which has you watching, because they're not necessarily cranked up in that regard. They're more plot twists and 100 characters pieces, and occasionally, you know, something fantastical happens on a regular basis. I don't know if that's if that's a fair judgment to lay against Choi Yun's movies, but it didn't seem like he tried out wildly colorful often.
He just had
his style.
Yeah.
And I guess the writing, Nick Wong's writing, was that as well. You know, Nick Wong maybe did not write material akin to Holy Flame of the Martial World and The Ghost Hill that took it to those levels. But I wouldn't know. He did write a lot.
He wrote an awful lot. I don't know how he found time.
He's a loser like me, just doing one thing. anything you want to add?
Nope.
Okay. Moving on to the plugging, I have two ones myself. In case you've forgotten, I'm actually the writer and the webmaster of SoGoodReviews.com. Latest review right now is the German DVD of Swordsman in Double Flag Town, a mainland Chinese wuxia piece. Very different one. And we're on YouTube as well, and those YouTube reviews are in the actual written reviews as well, so you have it nice and accessible. And I'm going to plug a movie that's coming out. I don't know if it's played theatrically, but I'm going to plug it anyway for people to be aware of it. It's a movie called Written By, directed by Wai Ka-Fai, founder of Milky Way, together with Johnny Toe, and he's directed a lot of things with Johnny Toe and some stuff on his own as well. The triad, quirky triad classic, Too Many Ways to Be Number One. He directed Peace Hotel with Chang Fat, Fantasia, the wonderful Lunar New Year movie, tribute to Hong Kong cinema, and The Himalaya Singh, which was basically a movie that didn't get any good reviews at all. A big old failure. Written By, I'm just going to see if I can get a good plot synopsis here. It stars Lau Ching-Wan, I'm reading here from a news item. The film revolves around a family who is involved in a deadly car accident. The lawyer father perishes in the crash, and the daughter loses her eyesight. Uplifting. 10 years later, the family, in particular the mother, still suffers from the loss, and in an effort to help her mother move on, the daughter decides to write an alternate reality novel in which the father is the only surviving member of the crash. And that's what that's where Lau Ching-Wan's role is in this alternate reality. And really, I haven't looked more at the plot because it sounds, quite intriguing and hopefully very clear also, and not the movie buried in art house sensibilities, but not a script that you see every day in Hong Kong. Where in this day of mainstream and slick movies, it's certainly a movie that could come with some substance. And Wai Ka-Fai, he's a pretty good visual director, even though in too many ways to be number one, it's not revolutionary to have a triad brawl. The camera upside down during the triad brawl, but within that movie, it's a genius choice because it's a fun, kooky movie. Which is actually, too many ways to be number one. It's structured similarly to Run, Lola, Run. You know the German movie, if you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
So it plays out two different, what happens if you do this choice and what happens if you do this choice. But within a world where triads are the most stupid people in the world, which they deserve to be. Triads are kooky, clownish, and pretty dumb. But it's lovely to see Lau Ching-Wan slowly get back, getting the dramatic vehicles and not only appearing in cheap romantic comedies, which was the case during a few years. He can be funny. I mean, really, really funny, but it seems like he didn't choose or get the meaty roles that he deserves, and he's a wonderful actor. And Mad Detective certainly got him back into the groove, and that was co-directed by Wai Ka-Fai and Johnny Toe, and this is merely directed by Wai Ka-Fai. I don't know if it's done under the Milky Way banner or not, but regardless, it sounds like an interesting film, and I should have done research, so right now I don't know if it has played in Hong Kong, but I'm sure a DVD will come out during the next few months and people can check it out that way as well. So, that's me. Do you have any plugging, Mike?
No. Screw everyone.
.com. nice and cynical end to the show, but this was casual time / bullshit time, and make of that what you will. But it's been a good little chat tonight, Mike. So
yeah, enjoyable. Enjoyable.
Yeah, cool.
If not a little weird not having Stu around.
It does feel a bit unusual, yeah. But so we look forward to
Stu. What did you think of the show? Excellent.
All right, I've been your host, Kenneth Bozo, with me.
Mike.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.